Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, December the 6th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled Northwestern Falters in National Title Match. Red Raiders take second best finish in school history. It's written by Ryan Timmerman. After already clinching its best finish in program history, the Northwestern College volleyball team came up just a few points shy of a national championship. The Red Raiders entered the NAIA Volleyball Championship Tournament as the top seed, but fell to second-seeded Indiana Wesleyan in front of five sets, 20-25, 25-20, 13-25, 25-17, and 15-10, at Fleet Farm Arena at the Tyson Event Center in Sioux City on Tuesday night. "What a fun run," said Northwestern head coach Kyle Van de Bosch. This team will be remembered. They took Northwestern further than it has ever been and set the standard higher for the program. Prior to the 2023 season, Northwestern had never made it further than the national quarterfinals. It was also the Red Raiders' first season with 30 or more wins as they ended with a record of 31-3. Northwestern got off to a promising start after taking the first set and reestablished control by dominating the third, but Indiana Wesleyan took it from there. "I thought we played really well in the first set," said Van den Bosch. "We were the aggressors, we attacked really well, and kept Indiana Wesleyan off the net with our serves." Indiana Wesleyan's Eva Joldersma led the match with 25 kills as the Wildcats finished off a 38-0 season, and setter Abigail Porter went for 58 assists. "We got away from our game plan early on," said Indiana Wesleyan head coach Candace Motes, "but we got back to it in the third set. Early on, we could not figure out how to block. Northwestern challenged us with everything. They had big hitters in every way, especially on the outside. We were undersized compared to them, but we had to battle for every point we could get. But I don't have words for what winning this means. I'll probably never have anything this great in my career." In the first set, Northwestern junior outside hitter Jaslyn DeHaan recorded her 500th kill of the season for the Red Raiders. She finished with a team-high 25 kills. Junior Allison Dexter added 20 kills, and sophomore Xavier Metzger had 4 kills and 5 block assists, as the Red Raider trio was also selected to the NAIA All-Tournament team. In the third set, Northwestern went for a blistering 21 kills as a team with a .525 swing percentage on 40 attempts, but the Red Raiders' efficiency mark otherwise was .190 in the first and fourth sets, but dropped to .171 in the second set loss. "I thought we pulled back a little bit in the second," Van den Bosch said, "but we did a good job of making them hit around our block. We just couldn't keep the momentum on our side in the fourth and fifth set." That number was a robust .211 in the decisive fifth set, but Indiana Wesleyan had just one kill error on 17 attempts for 9 kills in the fifth set to put it away, ending the Red Raiders' season 5 points shy of the school's first national volleyball title. Junior Liv Reitzma had 36 assists, and freshman Logan Miller added 20 for Northwestern, while junior libero Olivia Granstead went for a match-high 31 digs. While only one senior is listed on the Red Raiders roster, among the 9 juniors, 4 sophomores, and Miller, the only freshman on the varsity roster. Though a number of the listed juniors and seniors are seniors academically and stand to graduate, they're a year behind athletically should they choose to opt into their extra year of eligibility granted because of the missed season due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Regardless, Northwestern should not only stay largely intact heading into next season, but build off a record-setting season. "It's a special group," Van den Bosch, who's now been at the helm for 19 seasons at Northwestern, said. 5 points can make you feel a lot different. If those go our way, we're pretty excited right now, but sooner or later the sting will go away and they'll remember what a special year we had. We tried getting that first championship, but credit to Indiana Wesleyan. They were unbeaten all year and stayed pretty composed. The other story on the front page of the journal today is entitled Taylor Resigns as Vice Chair of County Board. It's written by Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal. The dateline is Sioux City. Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor has resigned from his position as Vice Chair of the Board of Supervisors, but remains in his seat representing District 5. The resignation was approved by the Board unanimously on Tuesday. Board members also voted to name Supervisor Mark Nelson as Taylor's replacement as Vice Chair for the remaining three board meetings of the year until a new board leadership is installed. Board Chairman Matthew Ung previously called Taylor's resignation as Vice Chair a ceremonial move, but said any move is appropriate given the public sentiment. Taylor spoke on Tuesday, stating he was elected by the public to do a job and he takes that job seriously. "I work hard to do the absolute best job I can," he said. "The voters hold us accountable every 4 years." He said he appreciates that the process is in the hands of the people and is not decided by the county auditor or a majority of the county board. He also said he appreciates the people who have stood by his family. The Woodbury County Deputy Sheriffs and Correctional Officers Union and the Western Iowa Labor Federation joined in asking Taylor to resign from the board amid his wife's voter fraud convictions. Representatives for the two organizations spoke at Tuesday's supervisor meeting, calling on Taylor to resign from the board. The statement read that Deputy Sage Lewis, on behalf of the union, asked Taylor to abstain from voting, discussing, and deliberating on any future issues related to the sheriff's office and the law enforcement center due to the conflict of interest caused by Kim Taylor's convictions. The union additionally said they are withdrawing any previous support or endorsement of Jeremy Taylor. Craig Levine spoke on behalf of the Western Iowa Labor Federation, a coalition of 500 state and local AFL-CIO labor councils, calling for Taylor to resign. He also asked the board to consider the resolution proposed by Auditor Pat Gill last week. Taylor said last week he plans to complete his current term, which expires in fall of 2024. "This will be a distraction," Ung said previously. "He is doing the public a disservice by not stepping down." He repeated the statement on Tuesday, saying the situation is going to continue to cause issues and create a distraction for board members. A federal jury convicted Taylor's wife, Kim, of 52 counts of voter fraud that government prosecutors say was part of a scheme to stuff the ballot box for her husband, who ran unsuccessfully for the Republican nomination for a U.S. House seat in the 2020 primary before winning election to the Board of Supervisors that fall. Three of the five members of the Board of Supervisors, Ung, Nelson, and Dan Bittinger, contacted by the Journal, called on Taylor to voluntarily step aside. The fifth member, Keith Radig, declined to comment. The Woodbury County Democrats Executive Committee also called on Taylor to step down. In Iowa, a county elected official can be removed by a petition filed by the county attorney, five registered voters in the district, or the Iowa Attorney General. Gill presented a proposed resolution last week that would have the board ask the Iowa Attorney General, Brenna Byrd, to investigate the voter fraud charges. If warranted, the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors requests the Iowa Attorney General file a petition for removal of Jeremy Taylor from the office of Woodbury County Supervisor, according to the resolution. Ung said the board members have stated their stance on the situation and will not stand in the way of any legal investigations, but added it is unnecessary for the board to endorse any petition or act on their own to file a petition. "The board has already spoken. Now is the time for the public to use their own voice and speak on their own behalf," he said. He added he has heard other individuals have spoken to Iowa Attorney General regarding the situation. Kim Taylor was convicted on November the 21st of 26 counts of providing false information in registering and voting, 23 counts of fraudulent voting, and 3 counts of fraudulent registration. Throughout the 6-day trial, prosecutors said that in 2020, Taylor, who was born in Vietnam, made contact with a number of Vietnamese voters with limited English language comprehension and filled out and signed voting forms and ballots for them and their English-speaking children in an attempt to stuff the ballot box for her husband. Prosecutors identified Jeremy Taylor as an unindicted co-conspirator in his wife's case, but he has not been charged. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ron Timmons, who was one of 3 prosecutors to present the federal government's case against Kim Taylor, declined to comment on any potential future indictments. The case is still under investigation. Jeremy Taylor, the county supervisor from District 5, previously represented District 2, winning 2 4-year terms. But he was forced to give up that seat in January of 2020 after a local voter challenged his residency in the district. After weighing testimony and evidence in the case, Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill revoked Taylor's voter registration, ruling his primary residence was a home outside the district on Christie Road rather than a home on Grandview Boulevard, where Taylor claimed he lived. After Taylor lost his bid in 2020 for the Republican nomination for the Iowa 4th Congressional District in June primary voting, he was selected in August by a special Republican county panel to be the county party's nominee for the supervisor. The Republican unseated Democratic incumbent Marty Potterbaum by around 1,800 votes in the November general election. Our next article is entitled Sioux City Man Who Was Shot Previously Beat Murder Charge. This is written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal, and dateline is Sioux City. A Sioux City man who beat a murder charge last month was identified by police as the victim of a Sunday night homicide. At 11:58 p.m. Sunday, police responded to a call of shots fired in the 500 block of 9th Street. At the scene, they found 31-year-old Nathaniel John Parker III with a single gunshot wound. Parker was pronounced dead at the scene. The incident remains under investigation. On November the 7th, a Woodbury County jury found Parker guilty of assault causing bodily injury for the February 24th death of William Harlan Jr., who was fatally stabbed in the back seat of a car in which Parker was riding with him. Parker had been charged with first-degree murder and had faced an automatic mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. Instead, he was found guilty of the lesser charge, a serious misdemeanor that carries a 1-year jail sentence. Parker had been in jail since his February 24th arrest. After the November the 7th verdict, jury district judge Jeffrey Neary, who presided over his trial, ordered Parker to be released from custody on his own recognizance, pending a November 21st sentencing hearing. At 4:38 a.m. on November the 8th, hours after getting out of jail, Parker was found climbing up a fire escape in the same block where he would be shot less than a month later. He was drunk, half naked, and had a minor stab wound. Parker was booked into the Woodbury County Jailer early on November the 8th on a charge of public intoxication, a simple misdemeanor. He pleaded guilty and received a 1-day suspended jail sentence. On November 21st, Neary sentenced Parker to probation for the stabbing. He gave Parker credit for 221 days served in jail while awaiting trial and suspended a 1-year jail sentence on a charge of assault causing bodily injury. Neary sentenced him to 30 days in jail on a related drug possession charge and credited Parker for time served. Parker was placed on probation for 1 year. Youth Orchestra to perform winter concert. The Sioux City Symphony Youth Orchestra will perform its winter concert at 3 p.m. Sunday at the Orpheum Theater, 528 Pierce Street. Entering its third season with two ensembles, the Youth Orchestra training program includes the strings-only Symphonia and a full symphony philharmonic. Led by Kristen Ortman, the Symphonia will perform works by Telemann, Campello, and Labrie and Moss. Led by Bradley Medema, the Philharmonic will perform music by J.S. Bach, Alfven, Jessel, von Supp, and Wagner. The concert is free and open to the public. A reception will follow in the Orpheum's lobby. The Youth Orchestra Training Program, Sioux City Symphony Orchestra's flagship education initiative, seeks to motivate and inspire progressing instrumentalists throughout the region in the pursuit of musical excellence. For more information on the tuition-free youth orchestras, call area code 712-277-2111 or email scsyo@siouxcitysymphony.org. Now this from the Nation and World page, U.S. sanctions Israel. Travel ban announced for extremist Jewish settlers in West Bank. This is written by Matthew Lee of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. In a rare punitive move against Israel, the U.S. State Department said Tuesday it will impose travel bans on extremist Jewish settlers implicated in a rash of recent attacks on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced the step after warning Israel last week that President Joe Biden's administration would take action over the attacks. Blinken did not announce individual visa bans, but Department spokesman Matthew Miller said the bans would be implemented starting Tuesday and would cover dozens of settlers and their families, with more to come if the settler violence continues. He wouldn't give a number and refused to identify any of those targeted due to confidentiality reasons. The decision comes as a sensitive moment in U.S.-Israeli relations. The Biden administration has firmly backed Israel since it was attacked on October the 7th by militant group Hamas, even as international criticism of Israel mounted. The Israeli embassy in Washington declined to comment on the development. Also on Tuesday, Israel said its troops entered Gaza's second-largest city as intensified bombardment sent streams of ambulances and cars racing to hospitals with wounded and dead Palestinians, including children, in a bloody new phase of the war. The military said its forces were in the heart of Khan Yunis, which has emerged as the first target in the expanded ground offensive into southern Gaza that Israel says aims to destroy Hamas. Military officials said they were engaged in the most intense day of battle since the ground offensive began more than 5 weeks ago, with heavy firefights also taking place in northern Gaza. In other developments, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the military would have to retain open-ended security control over the Gaza Strip long after the war ends. Netanyahu said Gaza would have to be demilitarized, and the only body capable of ensuring that would be the Israeli military. No international force can be responsible for this, he said at a news conference. I'm not ready to close my eyes and accept any other arrangement. The assault into the south is triggering a new wave of displaced Palestinians, raising warnings from relief groups that they can't keep up because supplies are insufficient and combat prevents distribution. Next is an article entitled Memorials Headed for Museum. Lewiston workers take down displays erected after 18 gunned down. This is written by David Sharp of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Lewiston, Maine. Volunteers and city workers on Tuesday removed mementos, signs, and other items that accumulated at the sites of the deadliest mass shooting in Maine history, reflecting a change in season and a new chapter in the era's recovery. The handwritten signs, cards, bouquets, and other items, more than 1,000 of them, will be archived, cataloged, and prepared for exhibition at a museum in Lewiston. Part of the process is practical. Snowfall makes it imperative to remove the materials before they're destroyed by either the elements or plows. Organizers also say it feels like the right time as communities continue to heal and grieve after 18 people were killed and 13 injured on October the 25th. We want to make sure the community doesn't forget what happened and how the community came together. So bringing the items together feels like next stage, said Rachel Ferrante, executive director of the Maine Museum of Innovation, Learning, and Labor, located at a former mill building in Lewiston. The memorials were heartbreaking and heartwarming. There were small sculptures of hands depicting the American Sign Language symbol for love, a nod for four members of the local deaf community who died, and there were countless signs, notes, and hearts, along with votive candles from vigils. Among the more offbeat items were a bowling ball, darts, and a miniature cornhole tribute. The victims were shot at a bowling alley and a bar that was hosting a cornhole tournament. The biggest item was a stuffed moose that is now waterlogged from snow and rain. More than 200 museum workers, volunteers, and city workers removed the memorials from three sites, the bowling alley and the bar where the shootings took place, and a busy street corner that became an impromptu memorial. We really wanted to save them before they were buried in more snow, and it's important to the community to do that, to make sure that there's some remembrance of this tragic event, said Tanya Hollander, a local artist. Senate okays hundreds of military promotions. Lawmakers act after Tuberville drops his policy-related blockade. This is written by Kevin Frecking of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. The Senate, in a single stroke Tuesday, approved about 425 military promotions, after Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama ended a months-long blockade of nominations over his opposition to a Pentagon abortion policy. Tuberville had been under pressure from members of both sides of the political aisle to end his holds as senators complained about the toll it was taking on service members and their families and on military readiness. President Joe Biden called the Senate's action long overdue and said the military confirmations should never have been held up. In the end, this was all pointless. Senator Tuberville and the Republicans who stood with him needlessly hurt hundreds of service members and military families and threatened our national security, all to push a partisan agenda. I hope no one forgets what he did, Biden said. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer teed up the military confirmations for a vote just a few hours after Tuberville emerged from a closed-door meeting and told reporters he's not going to hold the promotions of these people any longer. House Speaker links border to Ukraine aid. Johnson tells GOP changes are party's hill to die on in talks. This is written by Stephen Groves and Lisa Mascaro of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. House Speaker Mike Johnson told fellow Republicans on Tuesday that sweeping changes to U.S. border policy would be their hill to die on in negotiations that have already grown tense as Congress considers President Joe Biden's $110 billion package for the wars in Ukraine and Israel and other security needs. Johnson delivered the hardline message Tuesday morning ahead of classified briefings the Biden administration organized to underscore how desperately the aid is needed. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was scheduled to address the senators via video, but had to cancel his appearance, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said. Instead, the meeting erupted in frustration and yelling as Republicans insisted on including border security in the discussion. Democrats have dismissed the Republican border proposals as attempts to return to the draconian policies of former President Donald Trump. The Senate was headed to a test vote Wednesday, but Republicans promised to block it. The battle is for the border, Johnson said at a news conference. Now I'll read some shorter articles under the digest heading. First, climate talks to weigh future of fossil fuels. This is Dateline Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Day after days of shaving off the edges of key warming issues, climate negotiators Tuesday zeroed in on the tough job of dealing with the main cause of what's overheating the planet. Fossil fuels. As scientists, activists, and United Nations officials repeatedly detail how the world needs to phase out the use of coal, oil, and natural gas, the United Arab Emirates hosted conference opened Energy Transition Day with a session headlined by top officials of two oil companies. Negotiators produced a new 24-page draft of what's expected to be the core document of the COP28 UN talks, the global stocktake. The options in the draft of the future of fossil fuels ranges from a less stringent phased down of unabated coal power to an orderly and just phase out of fossil fuels. Whatever is adopted when the session ends next week has to be agreed upon by consensus. FBI chief urges renewal of surveillance tool. Dateline is Washington. FBI Director Christopher Wray called Tuesday for the reauthorization of a U.S. government surveillance tool set to expire at the end of the year, warning Senate lawmakers that there would be devastating consequences for public safety if the program is allowed to lapse. Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act allows the U.S. government to collect, without a warrant, the communications of targeted foreigners outside the U.S. Law enforcement and intelligence officials see the program as vital to combating terror attacks, cyber intrusions, espionage, and other foreign threats. Republican and Democratic lawmakers balked at renewing the program as it is, recommending reforms to better safeguard civil liberties. During Tuesday's hearing, lawmakers from both parties questioned Wray, at times aggressively, over periodic misuse of the program by FBI employees seeking out information about Americans. And there was an Osprey crash. Air Force Specialist Operations Command said Tuesday it identified the 8 service members lost when their Osprey crashed off of Japan last week and is focused on recovering all of their bodies and the aircraft debris. Impeachment probe. The U.S. House will vote next week on formally authorizing its impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden, Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, said Tuesday. House explosion. Officials said Tuesday that James Yu, age 56, owner of a Virginia house that exploded the prior day as police tried to execute a search warrant, is believed to have died in the blast. Details emerged about grievances he expressed on social media and in lawsuits. In the Ukraine war, the Netherlands announced Tuesday it would support Ukraine in 2024 with nearly $2.7 billion allocation amid Russia's invasion. Former President Peru's Constitutional Court ordered a humanitarian release Tuesday for imprisoned former President Alberto Fujimori, age 85, who was serving a 25-year sentence in the death squad slayings of 25 Peruvians in the 1990s. And Putin, seeking to reassert Russia's role in the Middle East, President Vladimir Putin will make a one-day trip to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia to focus on the Israeli-Hamas war, and then will host Iran's president in Moscow this week, the Kremlin said Tuesday. There are no opinions in the Sioux City Journal today, but there is this page entitled War in Gaza Analysis. Why comparing Hamas to the Islamic State misses the mark. Experts doubt Israel can ever eradicate militants completely. It's written by Yosef Fetterman of the Associated Press. It has become an Israeli mantra throughout the latest war in Gaza. Hamas is ISIS. Since the Hamas attack on October the 7th that triggered the conflict, Israeli leaders and commanders have likened the Palestinian militant group to the Islamic State group in virtually every speech and public statement. They point to Hamas's slaughter of hundreds of civilians and compare their mission to defeat Hamas to the U.S.-led campaign to defeat ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Hamas is ISIS, President and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared just after the attack. And just as the forces of civilization united to defeat ISIS, the forces of civilization must support Israel in defeating Hamas. But in many ways, these comparisons miss the mark by ignoring the homegrown origins and base of support for Hamas in Palestinian society and by assuming that this deeply embedded movement can be stamped out like a brush fire. These miscalculations may already have led to unrealistic expectations in Israel for victory. They also complicate fledgling efforts by the U.S. and other international mediators to end the war, which has devastated Gaza, displaced more than three-quarters of its population and killed over 13,300 Palestinians, according to health authorities in the Hamas-ruled territory. Here's a closer look at the campaigns against these very different militant groups and what it could mean for Israel's ground invasion and the future of Gaza. Is Hamas the same as the Islamic State group? The violent images of October the 7th brought to mind the scenes of cruelty unleashed by the Islamic State group during its short self-declared caliphate in Iraq and Syria nearly a decade ago. In an unprecedented attack, Hamas fighters burst into Israeli communities, killing entire families as they cowered in their homes, burning people alive and taking some 240 hostages, including older people and young children. Israeli authorities say at least 1,200 people were killed, some of whom were mutilated so badly they still have not been identified. In a late October interview with a Lebanese TV station, Ghazi Hamad, a senior Hamas official, said the October 7th rampage was just the first time and promised similar attacks in the future aimed at annihilating Israel. We must punish Israel, and we will do this again and again, he told the Lebanese channel LBC. While the Islamic State group also carried out gruesome killings, including beheading and setting live prisoners on fire, that is where many of the similarities end. IS fighters were mostly Iraqi and Syrian, but the group also managed to attract thousands of recruits for its global jihad movement from around the world, including Europe, Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, and the former Soviet Union. These foreigners often did not speak the local language, were seen as outsiders, and disliked by the local communities. The group has also taken responsibility for a string of deadly attacks across Europe, including in Paris and Brussels. In contrast, Hamas is an exclusively Palestinian movement. Its members are Palestinian, and its ideology, albeit violent, is focused on liberating what it says is occupied land through the destruction of Israel. While branded a terrorist group by Israel and its Western allies, its deadly attacks have been focused on Israeli targets. Hamas seized control of Gaza from the internationally recognized Palestinian Authority in the year 2007, a year after trouncing the PA's Fatah rulers in legislative elections. During its 16 years of rule, Hamas built up a system of government that includes not only its military wing, but also tens of thousands of teachers, civil servants, and police. The group has significant support outside the West Bank and exiled leadership spread out across the Arab world. A U.S.-led coalition defeated ISIS in Iraq in 2017 and in Syria 2 years later, though the group still has thousands of fighters in sleeper cells in both countries. Eradicating Hamas could be a much tougher task. Israel has already backed away from its initial pledges to wipe Hamas off the face of the earth, but given Hamas's deep roots, even its current goals of destroying the Hamas military and governing capabilities in Gaza still may be too ambitious. Michael Milstein, an expert on Palestinian affairs in Tel Aviv University and former head of the Palestinian desk in Israel's military intelligence, said the comparisons of Hamas to ISIS work in a limited context but otherwise are misleading. I do think that the slogan is right when you are trying to express and reflect the brutality of Hamas, he said. But of course, we're speaking about different entities. What is the future of Hamas? Hamas was established during the first Palestinian uprising against Israel occupation in the late 1980s and has survived repeated assassinations of its top leaders in four previous wars with Israel since the year 2008. While Israel claims to have inflicted heavy damage on the group during the latest war, much of its fighting force and network of tunnels appear to remain intact. Its exiled leadership maintains working relations with key countries like Egypt and Qatar. Nathan Brown, an expert on Hamas, said he doesn't see any way in which Hamas can be eradicated. By continually talking this way, the Israeli leadership is not just setting up expectations, but really, I think, digging themselves into a hole, he said. Israel has laid out its security demands for a post-war Gaza, but offered no plan for who might run the territory. Brown, a political science professor at George Washington University, said that after a bruising war, Hamas may be forced to reinvent itself, perhaps by controlling local residents' committees or going back to being an underground militant group. But he said it will maintain some sort of presence while remaining active in the West Bank and continuing to be a regional player. Hamas will be there, he said. Challenges for U.S. diplomacy. Israel's ambitious goals against Hamas have complicated the task of the U.S. as it works with Qatari and Egyptian mediators to end the war. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently traveled into the region to discuss, among other things, the principles for a post-war Gaza. For now, Israel remains committed to its goals. Netanyahu resumed its full-force strikes on Hamas after the ceasefire expired. This would mean an expansion of Israel's ground offensive into southern Gaza, where the vast majority of the territory's population is now concentrated, setting the stage for a complicated and bloody operation. The U.S., which initially backed Israel's war in Gaza, is now pressing Israel to avoid large-scale civilian casualties or mass displacement after fighting resumed. Through previous diplomatic efforts have been focused on extending the ceasefire, any formula to end the war would have to allow Israel to declare victory even if Hamas remains intact. Milstein says toppling Hamas's government and destroying its army remain feasible objectives, but he believes there is a growing awareness among Israeli decision makers that we cannot really make this organization vanish. You're listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. There are no obituaries in today's Sioux City Journal, so we'll move on to the sports page. And the top story there is Dodgers acknowledge meeting with Ohtani. The dateline is Nashville, Tennessee. Dave Roberts started to dodge the big question about Shohei Ohtani, rocking back and forth in his seat and staying silent for 3 seconds before his big admission. "Yeah, we met with him," the Los Angeles Dodgers manager said Tuesday at their winter meetings, making Roberts' club the first to publicly admit a sit-down with the unique two-way player likely to break baseball's salary record. Officials on other teams danced meticulously around the question as if choreographed by Bob Fosse. Toronto general manager Ross Atkins, who sparked speculation of a possible meeting by holding his Monday media availability on Zoom rather than at the winter meetings hotel, had this to say, "Some meetings that occur that don't occur, I'm not going to get into specifics of." New Chicago Cubs manager Craig Counsell batted away Ohtani questions as if in a cross-examination. After saying he had not met with Ohtani, Counsell was asked whether anyone in the Cubs front office had. Counsell replied, "I have not." Japanese pitcher Yoshinobu Yamamoto, another prized free agent, could be sought by the New York Yankees and Mets, who set payroll records this year in their third season under owner Steve Cohen. The Mets' projected final 2023 payroll is about $346 million, and their luxury tax, roughly $102 million. "I don't know if anybody can compete with Steve Cohen," Yankees general manager Brian Cashman said. "He's obviously a titan of industry. He's had a lot of success and built an empire, which has allowed him to do things like the Mets. We can just concentrate on what we're going to concentrate on. Obviously, it's a player of interest, and we'll compete for him and see where that takes us, and it will be enough or it won't be enough." In the meantime, the Yankees made a rare trade with the rival Boston Red Sox, acquiring outfielder Alex Verdugo for reliever Greg Weissert and two minor league pitchers. Only one relatively small signing was announced during the day. Tampa Bay agreed to a $1.1 million one-year contract with reliever Chris Devensky, a deal that includes a club option for 2025. Also, Cleveland won the MLB draft lottery and will have the top pick for the first time when selections are made July the 14th. Next in the college basketball top 25 roundup, number 20 Illinois beats number 11 FAU in Jimmy V Classic. Marcus Damask scored 33 points and Terrence Shannon Jr. had 31, both career highs as number 20 Illinois shot 63% and surged ahead in the second half for a 98-89 victory over number 11 Florida Atlantic in the Jimmy V Classic on Tuesday night. Playing in this event for the second consecutive year, the Fighting Illini, with a record of 7-1, won their fifth straight game thanks to Damask and Shannon, who combined for 47 points after halftime and were a combined 25 of 35 from the field. Damask shot 15 of 21 and surpassed his previous career high of 32 points set January 29th for Southern Illinois at Illinois State. Shannon went 10 for 14 and also hit 9 of 11 free throws. Vladislav Golden scored a career-best 23 points before fouling out in the final minutes for Florida Atlantic, who now has a record of 7-2. Number 5, Connecticut, 87. Number 9, North Carolina, 76. Cam Spencer had 23 points, 7 rebounds, and 6 assists as UConn pulled away down the stretch to beat North Carolina in the Jimmy V Classic. Number 2, Kansas, 88. Kansas City, 69. Kevin McCullough Jr. had a career-high 25 points. K.J. Adams scored 16 of his 18 points in the second half, and host Kansas struggled but held off scrappy Kansas City. Number 6, Baylor, 78. Seton Hall, 60. Ray Dennett had 17 points and 7 assists. True freshman Jacoby Walter scored 15 points with 4 three-pointers, and Baylor beat visiting Seton Hall in a Big East Big 12 battle. Number 7, Gonzaga, 111. Arkansas Pine Bluff, 71. Braden Huff scored 19 points. Graham Ike added 17 points in 17 minutes, and Gonzaga cruised past visiting Arkansas Pine Bluff. Number 14, BYU, 96. Evansville, 55. Jackson Robinson scored 19 points, and BYU routed visiting Evansville. Number 17, Tennessee, 87. George Mason, 66. Jonas Idu scored a career-high 17 points, and Tennessee rediscovered its defense in a victory over visiting George Mason. Number 19, Oklahoma, 72, Providence, 51. Javian McCollum scored 19 points, and Milos Uzan added 17 points and 12 rebounds as Oklahoma limited Providence to 20 second-half points in a home win. Number 23, Wisconsin, 70, Michigan State, 57. A.J. Storr matched a season high with 22 points, and Stephen Kroll scored a season high 18 points, leading Wisconsin over host Michigan State. And Grand Canyon, 79, number 25, San Diego State, 73. Ray Harrison scored 23 points, Gabe McLaughlin had 15 points and 13 rebounds, and Grand Canyon upset San Diego State in Phoenix for its first win over a ranked opponent. Next are some college football notes. Missouri's Schrader wins Burlsworth Trophy. Missouri running back Cody Schrader has won the Burlsworth Trophy, given to the nation's best player who started his Division I career as a walk-on. Schrader, who walked on 2 years ago after transferring from Division II Truman State, leads Division I with 124.9 yards rushing per game this season. He has rushed for 1,625 yards and 13 touchdowns and led the Tigers to a 10-win, 2-loss record. He was a unanimous Associated Press first-team All-Southeastern Conference selection this year. Ninth-ranked Missouri will play number 7 Ohio State in the Cotton Bowl on December the 29th. Schrader ran for more than 700 yards at Missouri last season before emerging as one of the nation's best running backs this season. In a 36-7 win over Tennessee, he became the first SEC player and 10th player in FBS history with 200-plus rushing yards and 100-plus receiving yards in the same game. He finished with 205 yards rushing and 321 total yards. Other finalists for the award were James Madison nose guard James Carpenter and Oklahoma receiver Drake Stoops. And Iowa defensive coordinator Parker wins Broyles Award. Iowa defensive coordinator Phil Parker was named winner of the Broyles Award, which is presented annually to the top assistant coach in college football. The Frank and Barbara Broyles Foundation presented the award during a ceremony Tuesday. Parker had been a semifinalist for the award last year. Parker, age 60, is in his 25th season on Iowa's coaching staff and 12th as defensive coordinator. The Hawkeyes, with a record of 10-3, have allowed 15 touchdowns in 13 games, and their 13.2-point defensive average ranks fourth nationally. Now here's some notes from the NFL. Lawrence may miss games with ankle sprain. Jacksonville Jaguars quarterback Trevor Lawrence has a high ankle sprain that could force him to miss the first game of his NFL career. Coach Doug Peterson said Tuesday that tests on Lawrence's right ankle showed everything's stable, everything's good. He added that surgery is not necessarily something that would be warranted at this time. We'll see where he's at in a couple days, Peterson said, roughly 12 hours after a 34-31 overtime loss to Cincinnati. Peterson said Lawrence's injury looked worse than it really was. Very fortunate there. He declined to say if Lawrence has a realistic shot at playing Sunday at Cleveland. I'm not going to put that timetable on Trevor, not going to put him in a box like that, Peterson said. We'll see how he is in a couple of days. The Jaguars will be without receiver Christian Kirk for some time because of a core muscle injury that likely will need surgery. Kirk was injured on Jacksonville's first offensive play, staying on the ground after a 26-yard gain and then gingerly walking to the locker room. It's Trubisky time in Pittsburgh. Mitch Trubisky's insists he's too worried about the New England Patriots to think about how the next few weeks might affect the arc of his career. Still, the number 2 overall draft pick in 2017 may be running out of opportunities to prove he can be an NFL starting quarterback. His next chance will begin on Thursday night when the Pittsburgh Steelers host the reeling Patriots. Kenny Pickett, who leapfrogged Trubisky on the depth chart 14 months ago, is out indefinitely after undergoing right ankle surgery on Monday. Two-time league MVP Patrick Mahomes headlines the list of 32 players chosen as finalists for the Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year Award. Each of the teams nominated one player for the prestigious honor named after the late Payton, a Hall of Fame running back for the Bears. The award recognizes a player for community service and excellence on the field. Detroit placed its best interior defensive lineman, Aleem McNeil, on injured reserve with a knee injury and signed cornerback Kendall Vildor off the practice squad. The Lions also added 36-year-old Tyson Alulu and offensive lineman Matt Farniok to the practice squad and released linebacker Raymond James from it. New York Giants' Tommy DeVito will remain New York's starting quarterback, even though veteran Tyrod Taylor is ready to come off injured reserve, Coach Brian Daboll announced Tuesday morning. And the New York Jets waived quarterback Tim Boyle after two starts and signed Brett Rypien off the Seattle Seahawks practice squad. Now here's an NBA story with an Iowa connection. Offense turns heads, but Pacers lean on defense in tourney run. This is written by the Associated Press, and the dateline is Indianapolis. The Indiana Pacers entertained fans with sprinter-like tempo and historic pace, scoring pace. They're heading to Las Vegas because of defense. After forcing 7 turnovers in a game-changing third quarter and 18 overall in Tuesday's 122-112 victory that eliminated Boston from the inaugural NBA in-season tournament, All-Star guard Tyrese Haliburton, formerly a Cyclone, took a moment to put the spotlight on something that once seemed unthinkable. Our defense was there. Could you tell? He joked. We wanted to be in this situation all year, and here we are. And it's not just about being here, it's about winning. So we're excited to go to Vegas and play some more defense. It's not that the league's worst-ranked scoring defense suddenly found a magical solution. But the Pacers threw a wrinkle at Boston in the second half and managed to hold one of the league's top teams scoreless for 86 of the final 117 seconds, long enough for Indiana to break a 105-105 tie with 9 straight points. We just changed some things schematically on defense there. Jason Tatum was doing a good job of attacking me in the first half, so we did a good job of changing it up a little bit and figuring it out defensively, Haliburton said. We got a couple of stops, and nobody wants to run with us when we're getting stops. The Pacers played so well, they were serenaded with the chant of defense, defense, a throwback to Coach Rick Carlisle's first stint with the Pacers and throughout ex-coach Frank Vogel's tenure, something few thought would return this season. It was a 61-point turnaround from an embarrassing 155-104 loss in the season's first matchup with Boston, one that Indiana used as motivation. Everybody saw what they did to us in Boston, so it was personal, Bruce Brown said. Offensively, there is little doubt that the Pacers' potency. They entered Tuesday leading the league in field goal percentage, assists, points in the paint, fast break points, and scoring, nearly 2 points above Denver's NBA single-season record from 1981 to 1982. The big question, how long can the Pacers keep playing two-way basketball? Despite spending most of the offseason talking about improved defense, Indiana is still allowing 125.2 points per game. But after winning the first tournament game, becoming the first group winner, and the first semifinalist, the Pacers are hoping to leave Las Vegas as the champions. In the NHL, Kings rally for 10th straight road win. Dateline Columbus, Ohio. Drew Doughty scored 33 seconds into overtime, and the Los Angeles Kings rallied from a 3-goal deficit in the third period to defeat the Columbus Blue Jackets 4-3 on Tuesday night for their NHL record-tying 10th consecutive road victory. Phoenix Copley stopped 26 shots for the Kings, who have won 7 of their last 8 games and matched the road win record of the 2006-2007 Buffalo Sabres. Philip Deneau scored twice, Arthur Kaliev added a goal, and Vladislav Garakov contributed a pair of assists in his first game back in Columbus after being traded in March. Kirill Marchenko, Johnny Gaudreau, and Matthew Oliver scored, and Elvis Merzlikins made 35 saves for the Blue Jackets. Columbus lost 8 games this season after holding a lead in the final 20 minutes. Senators 6, Rangers 2. Brady Tkachuk and Vladimir Tarasenko each scored 2 goals, and Ottawa picked up an impressive home victory over league-leading New York. Sharks beat the Islanders 5-4 in overtime. Thomas Hertl scored three times, including the tying goal with 1 minute 30 seconds left in regulation. William Eklund scored with 5 seconds to go in overtime, and San Jose defeated host New York. Red Wings 5, Sabres 3. Dylan Larkin scored twice. Robbie Fabry added a goal and an assist, and Detroit took a 4-0 lead before holding on in Buffalo. Predators 4, Blackhawks 3 in a shootout. Ryan O'Reilly scored in regulation and the shootout, and Nashville handed host Chicago its fourth consecutive loss. The Predators went 3-for-3 in the tiebreaker. Wild 5, Flames 2. Matt Boldy had 2 goals and an assist to lead Minnesota host over host Calgary. The Wild have won 4 straight games under John Hines. Avalanche 3, Ducks 2. Nathan MacKinnon had a goal and 2 assists, and Colorado held off a late rally from visiting Anaheim. MacKinnon's 2 assists gave him 500 for his career. And Devils 6, Canucks 5. Brothers Jack and Luke Hughes both scored. Jack added 2 assists, and New Jersey defeated host Vancouver and Quinn Hughes, who had 2 assists. And the NHL is bringing 2024 draft to Las Vegas. The last centralized NHL draft for the foreseeable future is going out with the glitz and bright lights of Vegas. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman said Tuesday the league is moving forward with holding the 2024 draft at the Sphere in Las Vegas, the new venue that opened in September and bills itself as the largest spherical structure in the world. Bettman said contracts still need to be finalized, but the league is excited about the possibilities for the draft. I think it'll be a pretty well-viewed event, both in terms of the draft itself and the viral use of the Sphere inside and outside using the globe. So we think it'll be fun. We think it'll be dramatic and compelling, Bettman said after the league's board of governors wrapped up 2 days of meetings in the market of the NHL's most recent franchise edition. The draft is expected to be the first sporting event to be held at the Sphere, and a showcase opportunity for the league before the draft decentralizes starting in 2025. I think both for the Sphere and for us, this will be a good event to show yet another capability to this magnificent, or of this magnificent theater, Bettman said. That pretty well exhausts the sports, so I'll read this one last article. It's called Relief at the Pump. Gas prices have fallen for 10 straight weeks. Here's a look at why. Written by Wyatt Grantham Phillips of the Associated Press. It's not just you. Across the U.S., prices at the pump have felt milder in recent months. Gas prices have fallen or remained steady since September the 19th, marking about a 70-day trajectory of decline, according to Andrew Gross, spokesperson for Motor Club AAA. As of November 28th, the national average for gas prices stood just below $3.25, according to AAA. That's down 25 cents from a month ago and 30 cents less than this time last year. Experts point to a recent decline in oil prices and a seasonal dip in demand, as well as easing inflation. Each penny decline in the national average saves motorists close to $3.8 million, according to Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy. If you amplify that 30 times, that times 30 cents, we're talking about Americans that are spending hundreds of millions of dollars less on gasoline today than they were a year ago. Despite the drop, the global energy market can be volatile and lower gas prices down the road aren't promised. Here's what you need to know. A few factors contribute to today's gas prices, but a big explanation behind the decline is seasonality. In other words, prices at the pump almost always ease a bit at this time of year. For starters, there's a switch to winter blend gasoline, which is cheaper to produce than the summer blend, and despite some upticks around the holidays, shorter days make hitting the road less enticing in colder months. It's dark and the weather is kind of crummy, and people just want to stay home, Gross said. Demand is a lot less in the fall and winter. On top of that, seasonal cycle inflation, while down from last year, is still high and continues to undercut American spending habits, which could also be contributing to today's lower demand, DeHaan added. Beyond demand, experts also point to declining oil costs. Prices at the pump are highly dependent on crude oil, which is in the main ingredient of gasoline. West Texas Intermediate crude, the U.S. benchmark, has stayed in the high to mid-$70 for the past 3 weeks, down from over $82 a month ago. While the downward trend in gas prices is expected to continue at least into the new year, anything's possible. Some experts point to the potential of more cuts from major producing OPEC countries, which boosted energy prices in the past. Earlier this year, Saudi Arabia and Russia notably extended their voluntary oil production cuts through the end of this year, trimming 1.3 billion barrels of crude out of the global market. The OPEC oil cartel made another big swipe at propping up lagging crude prices last Thursday, expanding some output cuts into next year and bringing Brazil into the fold. The Israel-Hamas war is also part of the global backdrop. The conflict initially slowed the fall in oil prices, but that progressively changed, Gross said, noting that the war has not expanded to large oil-producing countries in the Middle East. Still, the future remains uncertain. While gas prices nationwide are collectively falling, some states, of course, always have cheaper averages than others due to factors ranging from nearby refinery supply to local fuel requirements. As of November 28th, according to AAA, 15 states in the U.S. had prices below $3, with Texas, Mississippi, and Georgia at the lowest. Meanwhile, the states with the highest prices at the pump were led by California at $4.88, Hawaii at $4.72, and Washington at $4.34. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.